Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Hello.
And Benjamin Richardson.
Hello.
Now, if you two are together, some of my favourite nerds in the world,
I thought
we should do a lovely nerdy podcast. Now, we tend to get carried away on our lunch breaks talking about all sorts of different things, from the best fishing mini games in video games, to what we're going to talk about today, which we just randomly were talking about gameplay loops the other day. So we're going to stretch that into a whole podcast. Now, I promise it's more interesting than it sounds, because these sort of things dominate literally everything.
Particularly Sonic games.
Yes. Oh, cool. Oh, since you said Sonic, I'm going to open with a question from the hashtag WCGP tag, where people can sort of go on there on Twitter. If you want to leave questions, you know, thoughts and different bits and bobs that you'd like us to talk about, feel free to go over on Twitter, hashtag WCGP, leave us a question. We'll factor it in. That's what we will do for you. So in this one comes from Nicholas Coombs, who says, in honor of the Sonic movie, best and worst Sonic game. The catch is all the answers must be different.
Can I go first? Because yes. I have the most knowledge on this topic. The best and the worst is Shadow the Hedgehog. Not even a Sonic game.
Oh, the best and the worst.
Best and the worst.
Good.
One of the only ones I've ever played, so therefore it has to be.
That can count for both. Benji, what would you like?
Well, I thought Josh was given an ironic answer then until one he's played.
Yeah. it's bad, isn't it?
If this pains me to say it, but, well, it doesn't pain me that much, but Sonic Mania is the best Sonic game.
Oh, I was going to take Sonic Mania.
I was going to ask me 2 years ago and I would have said Sonic 3 and Lockdown with Knuckles is the best game ever.
Okay.
But it's actually somehow surpassed the worst Sonic game. Whoa, what a difficult selection. There's pretty much all of them from 2001 onwards.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you know that? Sonic 4?
No, to be fair, Sonic Colors is a very fine game about Sonic and a lovable bunch of chromatic sprites trying to save a theme park from being...
Are you having that one as your worst one?
No, that's a good one.
Okay.
My worst one... I don't know. Sonic, the one with the Sonic with the long arms where he looks like a moon bear.
Oh, the werewolf one.
Oh,
Sonic Unleashed.
With the Unleashed.
But that one is particularly bad.
With the werehog.
There's also one where there's Sonic's recontextualized as an Arthurian knight.
What? Okay.
I want to play that.
We're moving on from demonic territory. I will take the original as the best if I can't have Sonic Mania.
Sonic 2.
So no, the original.
Play it again.
No, I do all the time. It's best one. I like 3's snowboarding stuff, but I'll take 1.
Yeah, well, anyway, speaking of loops, Sonic 1, a lot of things people liked about it was the loop.
Yeah,
so that's a nice segue for you.
And then worst one, I'll have to take Sonic 2006, I think, or episode 1 of Sonic 4, something like that.
I will say, I'd like to play more, because I played a lot of Sonic games, all for about 5 minutes. I played the classic ones, my cousins used to play them. I played Sonic 06, I played Shadow the Hedgehog, obviously.
You didn't play Sonic Mania?
And I didn't play Sonic
Josh,
Mania, because I was too old.
I just lent you Assassin's Creed Odyssey. Can I take that back and I'll get you Sonic Mania?
You'll have to pry it out of my cold, dead hands.
Good, happy, as long as you play it.
I will invite you to my house to play Sonic Mania.
Yeah.
That sounds like the better scenario.
Whatever gets you playing Sonic Mania, and the rest of the world also, play Sonic Mania for the love of Sonic himself. But yeah, so that's hashtag WCGP. Please feel free to go on Twitter, leave us some things, and we'll get stuck in. But in terms of this podcast, we just literally thought we'd break down gameplay loops. Now, this, I did a dissertation on this stuff. Just to be fancy as hell from the opening gambit. There's a dude called Andrew Shabilsky who did a whole bunch of academic papers on how gameplay loops dominate gameplay and satisfaction and grind and all that type of stuff. All the lovely stuff. And I, like I said, I factored that into a dissertation that I did a few years ago. But I kind of want to put it out there, like, how much are you guys aware when you're playing a given game of how much you're in a gameplay loop? I.e., a given loop is, for example, in an RPG, you take a quest, you go do the quest, you turn it back in, you get the reward. It's that basic idea applied to every single genre.
Yes.
You tend to see it most of the time.
No, you didn't use to. Shabilsky's idea is about compulsion loops, which is a different thing that we'll get into later. But yeah, gameplay loops have existed since the very start of the medium. Like, they are the fundamental tenet. If you think of Pong, just what is the gameplay loop of Pong? The ball, or the pixels is, comes out of one side of the screen. You either hit it or you don't. And the feedback is either, you know, it goes to the other side and you score a point, or it goes past you and you lose a point. That is the very basic loop upon which that game is built. Pac-Man is similar. It's collect dots, clear the maze, repeat. You didn't used to see them quite so prominently back then because either they were very simplified, so it wasn't really a thing that you'd step back and study as a mechanic. It was just obvious. Or because it was games used to generally combine a lot of loops that would then progressively build. You see them now because they've become so fundamental in the commercialization of games, particularly games as services, when it comes to loot boxes and progression and paid for progression.
That was the thing with, like I said, across. Well, I've kind of got a bunch of different notes down, but like, you know, games across the, especially the middle and the end of the 2010s, just literally visualizing, like, you are doing this much damage. If you get this weapon, you'll do way more damage. Let's keep you hooked. Let's keep you on this
RPGs
loop.
Are an interesting example because they're one of the few genres that put the mechanics of the loops to the forefront and actually allow the player to see how the sausage is made, as it were.
Yeah, and then you try and upgrade and get a premium sausage to keep you going. What was the thing you were going to say, Jeff?
Just that over the, I think I agree with Benji in that, over the past decade especially, they've become more transparent in that you are, you know, engaging with this loop, whereas back in the day, you used Pong as an example. I suppose that was less, not obvious, but you sort of didn't notice.
It's not obvious because
it's
abstracted for one.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas now I feel like, especially in open world games, you have the core loop and then things are added on top of that, whether it's a story beat or a story mission or something else that is sort of slotted in between or to bolster the gameplay loop. Like, you have the meat and potatoes of the game, then you have these extra bells and whistles, which is supposed to set it apart. And it's a strange way to sort of make a game, but I do think it is sort of, it's just there to make you keep coming back and keep engaging in the systems and feel like you're grinding something.
I think Pong's a strange example because it's based on a real life sport, which
it's also like 50 years old.
Well, yeah, that's fine.
Some people might not have been here then.
Well,
everyone knows Pong.
I do.
I think they do, and like, it's something that everybody immediately understands without having played a video game, which is why it was so popular. It's basically just tennis. But if you look at something like Mario Brothers or even Pac-Man, as I mentioned before, as I say, it is an abstract concept and it doesn't have like a mandated goal. You figure that out. So you're not really focusing on what necessarily you're doing. You are just doing it. Whereas, as you say now, it's a checklist. It's literally ticking things off a list. And that makes you hyper aware of what the game's asking you to do and how it works.
It's like a numbers game, isn't it? Like, you need to clear out 10, you know, enemy bases, or you need to inflict 1,000 points of damage, whereas those systems might have always been there, but they were invisible. They weren't something you were cognizant of.
Roll it back here, because one of the key tenets of a gameplay loop, what we call it, the mental model, which is the player's understanding of the rules of the game and how through every iteration of going through the same loop, they update that and they come up with new solutions or they improve upon the existing solutions. Now, in a game like Super Mario Bros., within the first few seconds, you jump and it's designed so you're more than likely going to hit a block. And then you learn the rule is that if I jump and hit the block, something comes out of it. Right. Your mental model is updated. And then you take that into the next thing. You see an enemy, you think, okay, what if I jump on it? That works. And then again, that feedback. You at this moment, you don't know really what you're trying to do in the stage, where it's going to go. You don't have the end, you're going to jump on a flagpole. Mm-hmm. But by the time you get to it, because of your prior experiences, you have enough to have worked out and it feels like you've actually accomplished it yourself. It's like an aha moment. Whereas, as Josh is saying, the game upfront tells you, kill 10 enemies to get this experience and then you can move on to the next. If there is no mental model, it's just this. It's a set of instructions. Well, do this and do that.
Yeah, that's the thing that I was going to say about like recognizing this stuff when you play those games. Like, for me, games like The Division or Warframe or these big sort of, I mean, they tend to be the looter shooters where it's, like I said, the numbers ping off a certain character. You get given very specific goals. You have daily grinds to get back to. I'm very much aware that I sometimes refer to it as like junk food gaming. Like, I have to be in a very specific mood where I know it's going to take up like I can just lose 2-3 hours playing through this thing. And I don't know if that's the same with you guys where you sign up to that kind of thing.
Well, I think live services in particular are like a big example of how gameplay loops is like a sort of phrase and a concept has been kind of normalized for people who don't make games. And I think that's because when it comes to those types of experiences, you're supposed to be getting rewarded for your time, but the rewards come so like thick and fast that every 15 minutes or something you get a new weapon that you're supposed to trade out for an old one, and it rewards those short-term bursts, those daily challenges, to get you back into the game without it feeling like a chore. It's not like you're going to play it for 2 hours and then you're going to get a story beat or something. It's you're going to get a reward in 15 minutes if you check off this list, then you're going to do it again, and then you're going to get something else that keeps you engaged. And I think it's just a different way of trying to engage the player than how titles used to, where it was more... Well, the goals were either a bit more abstract, or they were more linear in their progression, that you were going from one story beat to the next, or one level to the next.
Or they were more meaningful. Yeah. As you've just mentioned there, it's a phrase or a term that players didn't used to be aware of, because most players didn't get to see inside the inner workings of game design. It was a mystery and it was something magical.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is like, because they've made them so much more obvious, for me it makes me bounce off stuff where I'm so aware of how I'm being played. Like, you know, go chase this like purple tier loot item. You know, whereas like in older games, maybe it's because we were younger and we wouldn't analyze it as much, but I feel like the more obvious they've made it, the more popular those games have become. But for me, less of the magic is there.
Well, more often than not, you didn't know what was around the next corner. And that's partly because your investment was different now. Because you're expecting the game to be so long, you need to know that the time you're putting in is going to actually be worth it. Mm-hmm. So it's important to constantly be giving players the rewards and also tell them that the reward is coming. Mm-hmm. Whereas before, you could withhold it for a while and just say, play the game and enjoy it.
Yeah, I think games do a bad job of telling you how long it's going to be as well.
This is why I think some people really struggle with a game like... And even me, I'm an example on this, like Animal Crossing, which doesn't have a very clearly defined goal. The idea is to just go in, be social, and just live in that village. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it has its own, its little micro loops, like it's fishing and it's digging and paying off your rent. So there is a feedback loop there. Mm-hmm. But like the overall objective isn't clear. You could play that for 5 hours and accomplish nothing.
Yeah.
But it's basically, you have to devise your own objectives, and that it's a hard sell.
I think I think transplanting that across to like open world stuff as well, like sometimes something like Assassin's Creed Odyssey, or like to some degree The Witcher 3, like you said, you bounced off that a little bit, and it's like the bigger you make those games, the bigger the loops get and the easier it is to fall off at what point you're supposed to be on.
It's because they trick you into believing that you're enjoying it.
The Witcher 3 is highly enjoyable.
No. See, The Witcher 3 is highly enjoyable, and this is a really important distinction.
Yes.
It's because you can very reductively boil down a lot of games to very similar loops nowadays, particularly open world RPGs, open world adventures, like The Witcher 3, like Fallout, like Skyrim, like Assassin's Creed, as mentioned. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily the loop itself that counts. It's the wallpaper that's plastered over the top. What drives you forward in The Witcher 3 are the characters, narrative, the settings. Not for me personally, because I became disinvested halfway through, and then I realised if I take all that away, I'm basically just doing the same thing over and over again and getting nothing out of it.
Mm-hmm. That's why I bounced off Assassin's Creed games in the mid-2000s, because it didn't have the set dressing to support the loop, and the loop was all it had. Every single time I unlocked a new area, I knew it would just be the same activity repeated, and I thought, why, if it's only going to be a bigger building or something that's artificial?
That's why a game like Anthem, which is what kicked off this discussion, it struggles so
before
much.
Before we started recording.
Yeah, it's because the core gameplay loop there is basically everything you've ever seen. It's by design, commercially, like it's commercialized. Mm-hmm. And the wallpaper on top of that has equally been picked to be the most commercially viable as well, which means it's totally soulless in both capacities.
Well, that's the thing, right? Does that, like, that immediately puts me off? But I guess there's probably, like, I mean, obviously, like, those games, like, Anthem still sold fairly well. I mean, obviously, its reputation isn't very good, but there is something of a market for people who want to know exactly what they're buying into. And something like a Ghost Recon Wildlands or The Division.
Well,
like,
that is, you know, that's your example of junk food.
Yes.
You buy it because you know exactly what it is and you know you'll enjoy it, even though it might not necessarily be the most nourishing or interesting experience.
But like you were saying about, or Josh, you mentioned, like, you know, that drive to get through something. Like, the newer Assassin's Creeds are very much content the game.
Yeah.
Like, here is a million different loops that you can invest in. And that's not necessary to discount that I do think AC Origins has a really good main character and a really good drive. Odyssey, less so. And, like, the DLC for Odyssey is just ridiculous. You go to, like, Atlantis, and it's just, here's more ridiculous stuff. But they're, like, up front and center just saying, like, here's more of the thing. Go do some more loops. And I go to those games when I've exhausted everything else. And I don't know if, like, because you play through Days Gone, which was kind of one of those games.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fine line, I think, because you get those that just do feel like junk food, and they're not giving you anything other than, you know, the satisfaction of engaging with the loop, whether that's killing zombies or looting bases or sneaking around or whatever. In Days Gone, for me, had just enough of a story in there and a world that I cared about to keep me going.
Right.
But like I said, stuff like the... But not more recent Assassin's Creeds, you know, the 2015's Assassin's Creeds, the Syndicates and such. Mm-hmm. They didn't have that draw, whereas something like Breath of the Wild, we were talking about this before we started recording, and that's slightly different, but essentially kind of the same, you know, where you're doing more or less the same thing.
You are, but the big difference with Breath of the Wild and why it's such a success is because it puts the focus on discovery. It doesn't have a checklist of, I mean, it sort of has a vague outline of what you should be doing, and you know, get powerful at beat Ganon. You know, if you go to shrines, you're going to improve and things like that. But you don't know where they are. It's up to you to find them and set your own objectives. And that's so much more engaging as a consequence.
Mm-hmm. So then, like Assassin's Creed, like in Syndicate, it's very much you're doing the same thing after 30 hours that you are after the first half hour. Whereas Assassin's Creed Origins and Odyssey, they give you this massive skill tree that you know it's like, okay, I'm not going to get to that for another sort of 10 hours. Breath of the Wild, though, gives you everything in the opening 20 minutes, but there are like ways to combine those elements, those different powers and physics models and stuff.
That's because it's,
you know, that you won't find for ages.
Because it all its core gameplay loops are there at the very start, as you say. You know how to kill enemies and using your items is exactly the same in hour 1 as it is in hour 50. Mm-hmm. But it sort of organically changes that based on how you learn to understand how the rules of the world work. It doesn't tell you all its rules up front, even though they exist. You have to discover them. Mm-hmm. Whereas other games will say, oh, you can use an axe to cut down a tree. And then you'll do that and you think, great.
No. But then,
the moment you discover that, in Breath of the Wild, it's a fantastic moment. It's one of those aha moments, and then you add it to your mental model and you take that forward, and it recontextualizes the previous challenges.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's it. All of the shrines in Breath of the Wild are, they're not cut and paste in the level design, but the way they look and stuff and the noises they make. But I was always shocked when I went in one of those shrines and completed it and then thought, have I done that the way the developers intended me to get out of that? Or have I just sort of, you know,
figured out
a weird way to do it? And that sort of sense of surprise and the experimentation with the mechanics does keep that game, like the element of surprise is so huge, and the mystery and the driving force of exploration and journeying through that map is like is what makes that game so special. The fact that you don't really have, you know, a pinpoint on a map, like you're going to just go straight towards and ignore everything else because you want to get to the next.
And if you do have a pinpoint on a map, it's one that you create yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, I was going to say, like something like you said, like chopping down the tree, Anthem, or even the new Dragon Ball has very specific goals. It would literally have said, right, now go chop down 20 trees. And it's like, and because you're making more visible the loop that's supposed to be in the background, it contributes to those other factors like immersion or like a drive to get through the whole thing, which I think that, like I said, so many other games just, they itemize everything and that makes it more boring.
It's such a Nintendo thing. And throughout the 90s and when Nintendo were at not necessarily the creative peak, but were considered at the time the only company that was doing it, used to refer to the Nintendo magic. Like that, they used to get compared to Disney like that. They'd sprinkle all the games with this ephemeral fantastical quality, and the trick is, like all good magicians, is to hide the magic. You know, when you hide how it's being done, you don't tell people up front this works because this works. You know, and they're one of the only companies who seem to do that these days.
Yeah, I think there'll be a big change going forward, because I think even EA at the minute are starting to like redistribute a lot of their teams and sort of try to prioritize creativity again. But the 2010s very much became endemic of like, this is a numerically driven industry. Like, you know, make the numbers go up, get invested in getting you loose, all that type of stuff.
I fell right off Ghost Recon, not Breakpoint, Wildlands, the one before, because that game is structured the exact same and is Far Cry 5. It's a miracle I completed Far Cry 5. I just about got through, because both those games have the same structure where you have a big map, you have lieutenants that are overseeing part of the map, and you need to do a handful of side missions in those areas to eventually face off against the lieutenant, take those out, and clear each area in the exact same way.
It's like a chore list.
It is like a chore list. When you see that on the screen, when you see everyone's face, when you do it once or twice, and you know that's the rest of the game, no matter how satisfying it is or how well drawn the characters are, there's something about seeing that and having the game play all its cards in the first few hours that just puts me off entirely.
Yeah, and I think that if I've got written down here, like, it reminds me of the arcade mentality where it's like, you know exactly what you were putting a coin in for. You're going to have this exact experience and it's going to be finite, and then you'll be away to do something else. They're forgettable, disposable experiences.
It's exactly the same as the arcade experience, except you pay all your coins up front. You pay 5,000 coins up front, or 50,000 coins up front, and then you're expecting, right, now I want 50,000 turns, so they have to give it to you.
But it's like, to the same token, like, you know, like I said, you knew exactly what you were buying into, but across the 2000s, it was this massive boom, even from companies like EA that were putting money into, like, the Simpsons game and Dead Space and everything, that were doing more sort of expansive games. I hope that in the next generation, we go back to that stuff again, where they realize that there is still a lucrative, you know, reality to variety and creativity. Creativity just as much as there is on doubling down on loops instead.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've been playing Red Dead Redemption 2 again recently, which I've talked about a lot.
I think it's interesting you bring this up. Okay. I'm waiting to see where you go with this.
And I know Benji has just finished, as he says, Horse Game 2, which I'm a big fan of. But playing that game, you can look at its sort of base mechanics and its base mission structure, which is very much ride to this place, shoot a bunch of people, ride back, probably get shot on the way back, yep. talk to your camp. And it's very kind of rote in the way it deals out most of its main story missions. There are some exceptions, but often it's like, put this wheel back on the wagon and stuff. But I don't mind that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Right. I just interrupt you there. The only times it doesn't, it deviates from that basic formula, it doesn't actually let you have any interaction.
Yes.
There's a part when you're building your house and it says, it's like, oh, you have to press X to hammer the nails in and rivet. But if you don't, it does it anyway.
Yeah.
Drove me mad.
This is it, right? Because there's so many valid criticisms of that style. Nakey Jakey has a great
video on the Rockstar's game design is outdated.
Yeah. And that is true, but for me, I don't mind so much because that is always, for me, scripted in such a way that gives you the optimum experience. Mm. It might not be very
well
conducive to video games and freedom, but the script and the presentation, the performances, yeah, for me, are always worth
forced. We're getting off topic bit here, but I'd say that although I agree with what you're saying, it doesn't necessarily work when it's cloaked within an open world exterior, because you're expecting one thing from the game and it's asking you to do something totally contrary during its missions.
Their argument would be that everything folds into the immersion, though.
But you're not immersed when you're being asked to do something in a mission that you could otherwise do in the open world, and it just literally won't let you, or it'll tell you that you're wrong for doing so.
Well, this has been the funny thing about this replay, because I'd never hit any of those walls the first time around. I must have done each mission exactly as the game intended me to. But this time, whether it's because I was impatient or whether because I'd done it before, I was just instinctively I was trying to sneak around here or this. And yeah, and then it's just like, nope, this was not the plan. Get back to the checkpoint and you're going to do it our way. And that's when I thought, oh, so this is what people don't like about Red Dead Redemption 2.
Yeah, I had that at one of the missions later on where you have to sneak into like a big factory to sort of like get to this office and extract some plans.
That's the one I did, yeah.
Right, it's not because I've been playing Assassin's Creed, but I just thought, well, you know, the goal is inside the building. I'm assuming because I'm playing games that I can climb something and go through an air vent or something. So I started climbing up these different outhouses and stuff, and I got onto the roof and I just missioned out and just said, you went too far.
And that's the frustrating part. If it had some kind of contingency for you doing that and it reacted to you doing that, even if it's just a guy who shoots you dead, I'd maybe be okay with it. But it's the fact that the option is there, you have taken the option, and then it just hits you with a hard wall of, nah, you're not doing it.
Yeah. And the mission just fails there. And it's not like, oh, okay, you've messed up here, you try and get out of this.
Mm-hmm. I guess like, when a gameplay loop becomes like a track, and it's just sort of like, I want you to go through exactly this and be satisfied exactly here, and if you didn't do that, we're not going to
It's kind of ironic. I finished Horse Game 2 recently, and I did overall enjoy the experience. I thought it was very patchy. It was disjointed in places and possibly a little bloated. But the best time I had with it was when I was actually not engaging in any of the gameplay loops, and I was literally just walking across the map and taking it in.
Right.
And that's when I think you look at a game, you think, actually, it's so much more, or there can be so much more than just the loops that underscore them.
That's the thing that I think clashes with this, because obviously you can boil down the vast majority of games to gameplay loops, and they are imperative to like what would be quote unquote fun. But I think something like Red Dead 2 gives you this massive interactive canvas of the Old West. And like you said, you're not on a particular loop or a track at that point, you're just drinking it in. And there's totally an intrinsic quality to that stuff that like doesn't need to sort of fall into the gameplay loop stuff. It's just, it's an interesting expansion of where games went that they couldn't be done in the 90s or couldn't be done in the 80s. Like you literally couldn't have something that looks like Red Dead 2 and has all those qualities if you didn't have the rendering capabilities for it. So I think that's an interesting way that like games have gone, that I haven't seen that many academic pieces like breaking it down yet.
I think we also have more games now. We did have some in the 90s, but not many, but more games now where the loop either is, it's barely existent, or it's up to the player to decide what it is. And I'm thinking of narrative fiction mostly, games like Gone Home and games like Her Story in particular. Even Return of the Obra Dinn, although it does give you feedback regular, like if you get the answers right, for the most part, it just asks you to take a step back and effectively solve the game outside the game.
I guess the loop in Obra Dinn would be filling the book out, and I guess
that's what I mean. It does have feedback in it, and there is an obvious goal in sight, and there is the loop would be go in, look at this thing, and then come back out of it. But the bit in between, the action from a player is think about it. That's what it's asking you to do.
I think it's interesting comparing it to, or factoring in game criticism as well. We can do a whole separate part on this stuff, but like you tend to find that in game criticism, like, you know, people who have reviewed games for a long time, like if they can identify the loop immediately and the game only repeats that loop over and over and over again, then that will go down in the score, unless they go down the whole like more objectivity route where it's like, okay, it's only aiming to perfect this one route, and then they just do that times 100. But I tend to find the more, like, you know, the likes of, like I said, something like Assassin's Creed Odyssey, it's like, okay, we know exactly what that thing's doing, and you'll be doing the same thing in 200 hours. Therefore, it's not going to score as highly as Red Dead.
It's a bit of bias in reviewer fatigue, because I've played this game 100 times, and I have to play another one of these really long games.
I played the first version of this loop, then the bigger version, then the bigger version, and it's nigh on the same thing. Do you think that the industry thinks it can mandate fun? Because I think a lot of these things like are circling around the idea that, you know, well, if we put this particular loop in, it'll be fun, it'll sell. And sometimes it works, but other times you get things like Anthem or Agents of Mayhem.
Well, it absolutely does work, unfortunately.
But things like Anthem totally fail.
I'm thinking about mobile games, which they don't so much mandate fun, but they try and interrupt fun specifically. They understand how to profit from fun by withdrawing fun. So you might be midway through a loop in Clash of Clans, for example, and then suddenly it'll come up with a big block on the screen saying, right, you need to pay to continue, or you need to pay to get this resource.
Yeah. I was going to mention as well that I think that idea of interrupting the loop is one of the most effective things. I think From Software do it incredibly well, where it's like, okay, you've trained, you've got all your armor, you've like been, you know, grinding away for ages, you've put all the time in, but we're going to interrupt this completion by just killing you before you can beat the boss. And then that is such a compelling reason to get back and finish it.
I don't mean to be vulgar, but it's like video game blue balls. It's an awful thing to do with a player.
On a podcast, no less. But yeah, I think all those things, because it's hard to not see games like that once you're aware of things like, you know, we mentioned compulsion loops and gameplay.
Just MMOs are built on it. Built on the idea that you can log on and accomplish something within the space of 5 minutes, and you don't realize actually what you've just done is meaningless.
I'll go on, Josh.
No, I was going to say, Benji has made a good point there about like the critic sort of fatigue of MMOs are a good example, because usually, and correct me if I'm wrong, usually you play one MMO, like you have your MMO, whether it's Warcraft or whatever, and you log on every day and you play it, whereas live service games now are aping the structure of an MMO, but there are so many of them and they're all vying for your attention that if you do jump from one to another, it's so transparent how they're built and how they're crafted, and that just does lead to you either being burnt out or wondering what the point is or where the fun is supposed to be.
I was going
to
say, you can't go from one game that has dailies and has like, you know, cut down 20 trees, go get 5 things, go plunder 5 dungeons, straight into another game that does exactly that, because it is fatiguing and it is tedious to some degree.
Because so many games are like that, it's also the reason why people get so perplexed when a game dares to try a new system or a different control scheme, or, you know, like you don't shoot by pressing the triggers, for example, and people think this is wrong, this is not how a game should be. It's almost like the industry's now defined what fun is, rather than being out for player.
Me and you, we used to shoot with the face buttons.
I still do, if I can.
I did a little bit.
Did you?
I used to, shocked me going back to some PlayStation 2 game, like even one game that I loved, and you couldn't move where the gun was aiming. Like, you had to press L2 or something to, in a first person shooter, no less, to
and
aim.
Just hope for the best.
GoldenEye is really interesting in that regard, because James Bond, despite being a master of weaponry and, you know, a super spy, he can't shoot accurately unless he stands perfectly still. He can't shoot on the
That's
run.
That's what they taught him in the academy. That's just what he does. Because, yeah, we mentioned, or we've noted down the idea of like genre expectations based on these loops. And like I said, it ties in with the whole idea of mandating fun and profitability, which I think the industry goes so back and forward on. It's such a whiplash. Like I saw the thing that Housemarque have delayed Stormdivers, which was their attempt at a battle royale. Now, we know exactly what that game would have been. Minus, like, you know, they assumedly have some different character type they should do with a katana.
It's an interesting thing you say that we know exactly what the game would be, and now a developer can or a publisher more likely or can quite comfortably come out and say, here's franchise X, popular franchise X, it's going to be popular genre Y.
Yeah.
And immediately people get excited because they think, oh, it's going to be great, I know that. Whereas before you could... But you didn't know what a game was going to be until it came out.
I think the general sentiment before launch back like in the early 2000s was, I wonder what they're going to do this time, as opposed to, I know what I'm going to get this time.
Yeah, yeah, it's like the game industry has been heavily codified, and now you select the type, the theme and the type of game from a library, put them together and sell it.
And I think, you know, oftentimes it's everything as in well. The AAA it's not industry, just sorry. The gameplay loop, it's the way the UI looks, it's the way the character models are designed. The Outriders trailer dropped, was Outriders?
Yesterday.
Outriders trailer
afternoon,
dropped.
Yeah.
Yesterday afternoon. It looks like a satisfying game, but it also looks like a bunch of games I've played before, if that makes sense.
I'm Destiny glad you mentioned the UI, because Red Dead 2, since you mentioned it before, the UX, to use an awful language of designers, but it's terrible. It's like it's objectively terrible, but I really appreciate that it's different. Like if it tried something and it didn't work, and it feels unique at the very least, even though it's utterly cumbersome.
See, I was going to say that about Death Stranding. I love that game felt different. And I know that obviously there are comparisons.
I was like going to say a lot of Death Stranding I thought was a meta criticism, or even it's quite like an ironic take on some of these.
I was going to say you had a whole point conventions. About the way that the weight allocation's done.
Yeah, it's well basically Hideo Kojima looked at what's all the things people hate about games and made that into a game itself. Like he's not looking at fun gameplay loops. He's looking at the bits, the external bits that are designed to slow down those loops, and thought, what if this was the game? And I think it's very interesting. I mean, I think I've mentioned before, it's his equivalent of Damien Hirst's Crystal Skull. The idea is, will people buy this bag of rubbish? And the answer was not in the extent volumes you thought it was hoping.
Because like Death Stranding, obviously it's kind of like Fetch Quest the game, but even like when you decide to load Sam up with all these different items and stuff, you can just press auto allocate instead. You can just take the shortcut, and there's other different sort of comments in that game about, you know, streamlining stuff and just trying to connect with everybody.
The fact that the UI is literally unreadable and just overloaded with information, which I think, again, you don't need to know any of it. You literally don't need to read any of it to do what that game wants you to do. And I think, again, that's commentary on, as Josh was saying before, like the typical like information overload of UIs, of the checklists and the chores that you have to do, all these loops, to use a better word, hoops I should say, that you have to jump through. You know, I was very clever in that regard, even if it's not necessarily fun.
It just makes you think, like, all these things, all these sort of, like, that idea that you can play directly into making a video game, and it comes with XP bars and loot grinds and, like, all these different monetization practices and all these things that we've come to expect, but all those loops are super obvious, and for me, like I said, I'll bounce off them super quickly. Or you can have something that has more of the Nintendo magic or the Naughty Dog or the Rockstar magic, and a lot of those loops are buried in underneath.
Well, I think the perverse genius of it is that, like, publishers and marketers especially have managed to commercialize terms like gameplay loops. Yeah. We were looking at the Anthem press release, and it mentioned in there that we're going to go back to the drawing board and, you know, change around the gameplay loops and this core central experience.
It's part of the wider issue I have. I really struggle to explain why it annoys me so much. Of basically games,
you're going to complain about the word campaign.
I am because this is a manifestation of that problem. Games being stripped of the soul, so that you just consider them in very, very, like, brusque mechanical terms, like the campaign's gameplay loop will be like excellent. Like, that's a thing that a publisher can say, and a consumer
now understands
you can obtain premium loop from the game's campaign's gameplay loops. That's not that's internal design speak. That's not
When you first mentioned this to me, I think there's a way to look at it that is more positive in terms of, like, you know, the gaming industry and gamers, we have our own language.
That's nice.
That stuff's good.
And it's great that we have a jargon that we all understand, and we always have, because if you look back, the word boss, what on earth does that mean, really? It's a strange thing. Like, level is a strange word.
Yeah, why do we use level in today's climate?
Complete tangent, but I was little and I was starting to talk to people and friends about games in school, I wondered whether boss was just a term my dad made up. Like, I didn't know if it was like regular.
Do you want to know?
Lexicon?
It comes from Gallagher.
Does it really?
Boss Gallagher.
Gallagher?
Yeah, one of our esteemed colleagues.
See, I love doing this.
Do you mean that the term came from a boss in Gallagher, or we have a dude called Gallagher who works
No, no, that's just a coincidence. Okay. He did not invent it. I know he's as old as hills.
Let me start referring to Si as Boss Gallagher now.
It was, I think it was referred to in the instruction manual of Gallagher.
Right.
It was called the Boss Gallagher.
Okay.
And then that, why they use the word boss, I don't know. It's obviously a hierarchical thing from Japanese business.
Chap.
Hey, it's stuck, you know? That's all that matters.
It worked all right. I think we can end on just, we sort of had a couple of different games down that, you know, we can sort of pinpoint. Josh, you said you went back to old Metal Gear, and it's like, as much as like that one is, you know, a stealth game, it's known for it, but you said that game kind of brings in a bunch of different genres and makes it work.
Yeah, I mean, like, I went back to Metal Gear after playing a bunch of current gen stuff and kind of getting a bit burnt out on it, and I was surprised that of how little sneaking around and breaking people's necks you do in that game, because I think of Metal Gear from my childhood. You can, there is still lots of it, but it's not as consistent as I remembered it being. It's not level after level. It's one level, then it's a boss, then it's, oh my God, you're running down the side of a building away from a helicopter and stuff. And it does such a good job of giving you these new mechanics and new enemies and new gameplay scenarios rather than a gameplay loop. Mm-hmm. It still occasionally defaults back to the sneaking, but that's 40% of the whole game. It's always new.
Of course, the new scenarios are underpinned by the previous loops, but they're just being used in a new context, which is one game I've been playing recently. I'm just looking for an excuse to talk about. It's Luigi's Mansion 3, which came out last year, and I can't really understand why it didn't get more attention. So the basic loop in that game is that you've got a Hoover, and you Hoover things. That is the game. That is the entire game.
You get whip stuff.
Yeah, you do. You also can use a little sucky thing that goes like that. But I know what I'm doing every room. I'm going to go in, hoover everything up, some ghosts will come, I'll hoover them up, and then the lights will come on. That is fully. But I'm excited to see where it goes, because I'm thinking of all the new ways in which it's going to use this hoover, this vacuum cleaner, like the new context that I can suck and blow on. I know it's not going to be the same at the end as it is at the start.
I was going to say, if that game threw up on screen, go to five different ghosts and...
You wouldn't do it.
Well, right? Yeah. Like, I don't know.
It wouldn't be fun.
The more they visualize that, the more it becomes more like an Activision game or an Ubisoft game. And if that takes away from what's actually hooking you right now. Like, the thing that's hooking you right now is that you're lost in it, assumedly.
I will compare the Metal Gear Solid 1 game to Metal Gear Solid 5, because I loved the loop of that, sneaking into base and stuff, very mechanically satisfying. But the problem I had with that game is it gives you a bunch of stuff, and it says... infiltrate how you want, and I say but no, because I've got one optimum solution to every problem.
This is what gamers do. They destroy your lovely designs. What they'll do is they'll find a cheat and find the easiest way to do things, even if it's not the most fun.
But genuinely, exactly that.
Well, when we were redesigning the website a couple of years ago, there was like this image of like a really well cut piece of grass and like a path that went around like this 90 degree like corner, and it was like, you know, like the intended experience, and then just like a dirt path carved through the grass, meeting both points on the pathway. Just saying, like, the user experience.
I literally have one of those outside my house. Mm-hmm. Like, there's just as a field, and you have to walk up a hill and round it. It's lit, but there's just a path furrowed directly through over a fence. Yeah, I understand it. I do it as well.
It's the way. I think to bring all of it together, I wanted to mention a quote from Hugo Martin, which is the creative director on Doom Eternal. Because for me, I'm curious on Doom Eternal. I love me some Doom, but Doom Eternal is very much, and to quote him, a video game ass video game. Because they said they've brought in all these different XP bars and brightly colored power ups, and they were in 2016's one. XP bars weren't, but at the end of each level now, you get the big shiny firework display of like, you've unlocked this and ping 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 and all these different things, and it's like, oh my God, it's a game, look at this thing, look at what you're doing. And for me, that makes me go, I don't want that. I don't want you to be Ubisoft.
Do you remember when completing a level was rewarding itself?
Yes. And I didn't need this thing, freaking out and give me a little mini fireworks display and a little, give me a dab. I don't need it.
It's part of a much larger conversation, I suppose. But I thought this when achievements and trophies started being a thing.
I thought it too.
I wondered why I was doing stuff beforehand. I remember like going back to older games, like PlayStation games, and thinking, I used to just experiment and try to have fun. And now if there's no tangible reward attached to it, I think, what's the point? And then I'm really disappointed in myself for thinking that way.
Ironically, the only games I ever really, really want to find everything I do 100% in are Nintendo games. They internally incentivize me to do it because the actual process is fun.
I have more or less one. I know we're going on, but this is a good conversation, I think. And that's a good point, Ben, because when I play my Switch, I feel so unencumbered by systems. When I'm playing PlayStation 4 games, as much as I love them, I feel like I'm just like overwhelmed by features and systems and loops and mechanics, whereas Nintendo, like you said, has that magic, it has that freedom, it has that simplicity, or at least the illusion of simplicity, where It feels like I'm a kid again. It feels like I'm doing stuff for the pure joy of doing it.
Genuinely, when I went through Breath of the Wild, it reminded me of what the pure beauty core of gaming is. And that sounds cheesy as hell, but there was something about that game that was so pure.
Here's an example from Luigi's Mansion.
Oh, but there's always Luigi's Mansion, is it?
It's a slight spoiler for this game, but you have to rescue some of your mates who have been trapped in paintings. And at one point, you rescue one of the little toads.
I was going to say, is it Toad?
Yeah, one of them's a little toad. Obviously, the first toad. One you get, because he's the least important. But you have to take him back to the lab. So you escort him through about three rooms, and all ghosts are gone. So it's basically just a case of walking. Mm. But because, while you're doing it, there's a couple of rooms left to explore. And obviously, you're blown around with your Hoover. And he can, if he walks in front of you, you'll accidentally suck up a little toad, and you go, he'll get sucked up on it in your vacuum, and then you can ping him out, and he bounces off the walls. And there's no application for this because you've already solved all the puzzles, and you only have him for two rooms. And that just made me so happy, more happy than the whole 80 hours of Red Dead 2.
I was going to say any other game would have pointed to it and said, "Do this 20 times. Make sure you're doing this thing we made."
Yeah,
which
it's totally missable as well. It's just.
That idea of like the true genius of a game being something that you have to stumble upon to as opposed to being front loaded is the best stuff in games. And I think that across the 2010s, so many different devs went away from that.
Yeah.
But going forward, I mean, hopefully like the next generation will bring those things in. If EA can change, and maybe they can, then maybe there's hope for us all. But yes, for now, this has been the What Culture Gaming Podcast. Please head over to social media and use the hashtag WCGP to leave your thoughts and questions, and we'll get round to them next time. For now, though, I've been Scott from WhatCulture.com, and this has been Josh Brown. That's not how I usually do that at all. How did I do that?
I was getting ready for this to say it. I'm Josh from WhatCulture.
I've been your host for Telford, joined by Josh Brown.
Goodbye.
I'm Benjamin Richardson.
Goodbye.
Bye.
See ya.
Ciao.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.